Today is Friday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the latest on U.S.-Iran tensions after Washington called off military activity Thursday. Also, Chinese President Xi Jinping concludes his two-day visit to North Korea.
The only thing really that you can see at this point is some kind of, possibly a promise that was made behind the scenes.
And NASA sent two men to the moon almost 50 years ago. How is it being remembered? These stories and more are just ahead on today's International Edition. Major airlines from around the world on Friday began rerouting flights to avoid areas around the Strait of Hormuz after Iran shot down a U.S. military surveillance drone there as America warned that commercial airliners could be mistakenly attacked. U.S. President Donald Trump approved military strikes against Iran, but then pulled back from launching them. The New York Times reported Trump initially authorized attacks on a handful of Iranian targets such as radar and missile batteries. Then the Washington Post and other media subsequently also reported that administration officials said the president approved the counterstrikes. Meanwhile, Reuters reported that Iranian government officials told the news agency that it had received a message from President Trump via Oman overnight warning of an imminent attack. Reuters said that Tehran's immediate response to Trump's message was a stark warning over regional and international consequences if the U.S. undertook any military action. Today, the FARS news agency states Iran told the United States via the Swiss ambassador that Washington will be responsible for any consequences of military action against Iran. President Trump took to Twitter this morning about Iran, and to learn more, I spoke with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, can you kind of walk us through what the president has mentioned this morning via his Twitter account?
Well, President Donald Trump, using Twitter, which he does so often to communicate on major issues, went out and he tweeted that Iran on Monday shot down the unmanned drone, which has raised tensions even more in the region. And then he wrote in one of these tweets, we were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night, he wrote, on three different sites, he said. And that's when he said in this tweet, he asked how many people were going to die, and one of the generals that he was speaking to said attacking these three sites would kill 150 people. And then he said 10 minutes before the strike was supposed to launch, he called it off because it wasn't proportionate. And then he then raised the ante a little bit, leaving the threat of military strikes against Iran out there, saying he's in no hurry. The military is rebuilt anew and, in quotes, ready to go and the best in the world. He also said that the sanctions are biting and that he added more last night. So continuing his maximum pressure campaign, which is aimed, according to his administration, to squeeze Iran, force it back to the negotiating table to renegotiate a nuclear deal that will limit its ability to sponsor terrorism, to pursue ballistic missile technology, and that's where we are at the moment.
You mentioned in the president's tweet that he said that the U.S. response was not proportionate. Has there been any clarification on what the president meant by that?
I think the concern here is the danger of escalation, and according to some of the reporting that came out overnight before the president tweeted here in the U.S., was that there were concerns by the military that a strike that killed actual Iranian people, personnel, even military personnel on the ground, would raise the stakes because you had Iran. What Iran said it did is it shot down basically a flying robot, an unmanned aerial drone, a very expensive one, but no lives were lost. The concern is, it seems, that if you then strike back and you take lives, well, then Iran is perhaps going to feel that the only retribution that is fair is if it responds and takes American lives. And, of course, there's been an ongoing concern about the safety of U.S. personnel, military personnel in Iraq and Syria, of U.S. assets, interests, and even private citizens in the Middle East, where Iran has some reach.
Leaders from around the globe, including U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, have called for cooler heads to prevail, for dialogue to begin to de-escalate the situation. Has there been any outreach to start that pathway for talks?
the pathway for talks right now is really going through back channels. You have the Swiss consulate in Tehran, which often will act as a messenger for the U.S., as the U.S. no longer has any diplomatic facilities in Iran and hasn't for quite some time. There's also the reporting that we talked about, where there are these back channels through Oman, where the U.S. was sending messages to Iran, we're going to strike, you need to come to the table or else. And then, of course, the strikes were called off. So there are some back channels, but really the international community is just voicing concern that, and concern we've also heard from senior military personnel in the U.S., that there's a huge risk for miscalculation on the part of Iran and also the part of the U.S. And if something goes just a little bit wrong, both countries could see themselves with fewer and fewer options to respond, leaving them with really only a few choices, including all-out war.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Thank you so much for your time today.
Anytime.
The U.S. says it has also asked the U.N. Security Council to meet Monday behind closed doors to discuss Iran. And Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said Democrat leaders have emphasized that hostilities must not be initiated without the approval of Congress. Chinese President Xi Jinping has concluded his two-day state visit to Pyongyang, where he met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. During Xi's time in North Korea, he got a lavish reception that included thousands of people holding up placards that formed the picture of Xi's face and the Chinese flag. He also received a performance of the song, I Love Thee, China. To get a wrap on the summit, I spoke with VOA Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide. Bill, what can you tell us about how North Korean and Chinese state media have been covering the summit?
Well, this whole trip was a very lavish affair. If you've watched or seen any of the video of the welcoming that Xi Jinping has had to this mass celebration at May Stadium, it's huge. And really, the whole message and the narrative that state media has been trying to convey is this is a friendship that has been around for a long time, and it's going to continue to be strong. And these two leaders, Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un, are the ones to kind of keep that friendship going. You know, it almost had a feel like the two were starting a bromance of sorts, like we've seen between Xi Jinping and Putin. But not the analysts that we were speaking with tell us that's not quite the case. Really, what we see here is both countries trying to align their strategic interests.
Right, and that's what I kind of want to follow up on next, because like you mentioned, North Korean state media said that Kim and Xi agree that strengthening bilateral ties at a time of serious and complicated international affairs is good for regional peace. But if you look back over the last few years, what's been the relationship between Pyongyang and Beijing?
Yeah, that's the backstory really here, that the relationship has not been good. Kim has been, you know, testing missiles, carrying out nuclear tests until only recently, right? And so the relationship was really troubled. China, along with other nations in the United Nations, have backed some of the strongest sanctions to date against China. So it's a very troubled, a very tough relationship that has long been described as being close as lips and teeth, right? But this has only started to take a turn over the past year or so as the U.S. has started to reach out to North Korea, and Kim has come to Beijing to visit as well. But Xi has held off up until this point. And some of the analysts that we're speaking with say that there might be a connection between the timing of this visit and next week's G20 summit, where Xi and Trump are expected, President Trump are expected to meet on the sidelines there, that maybe perhaps Xi is trying to highlight China's relationship, strong relationship with North Korea, and the role it could play possibly in helping the nuclear, address the denuclearization, the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula, and have something up his sleeve he can take to that meeting next week.
Has he given any indication as to what that may be? Because like you mentioned, the G20 is next week in Tokyo, and we have a situation where talks are stalled between Washington and Pyongyang, as well as Washington and Beijing on the trade front.
Yeah, it's the only thing really that you can see at this point is some kind of, possibly a promise that was made behind the scenes that then Xi could take to Trump next week, but we really don't know. I mean, all that we're seeing is a very superficial display, right, of the closeness of that relationship. And this is something that's very, hyped up. Even when Chinese are watching in China are watching this display, and all the North Koreans cheering on Kim Jong-un, it reminds them of 30, 40 years ago, and how there was this cult of personality with leadership here in China. And it's something that today it seems very foreign to them in many extents. And so what is it, what is it that Xi Jinping can bring to the table? I don't know. Maybe over the next few days we might get a little bit clearer idea of maybe something a little bit more concrete that was given, or some kind of pledge that Kim Jong-un made during their talks and discussions.
Bill Ide is VOA's Beijing bureau chief, who's joining me by phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
Here are other major stories from around the globe. 18 members of the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara were killed in a joint operation by U.S., French, and Niger troops near Niger's border with Mali. The Nigerian government has announced a ban on begging, which is prevalent in the north as a major form of support for religious schools. Zimbabwe is on edge as many civil servants and private sector employees around the country threaten to strike Monday. The economic downturn has prompted many to find different ways of pressuring the government to act on making payments in U.S. dollars, controlling prices of basic commodities, and just making life more livable for many. You'll find these stories and more on our website. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study published in 2016 is currently creating a bit of a buzz on the internet. The study by a pair of researchers from Australia's University of the Sunshine Coast provides evidence that an overuse of cell phones and other handheld devices are causing some young people to develop horn-like bone growths at the back of their skulls. Doctors David Shahar and Mark Sayers analyzed 218 x-rays of people who were between 18 and 30 years old. They say that 41% of them showed a 10 to 30 millimeter bony lump at the base of their skulls. The researchers theorize that moving the head forward to accommodate mobile phone use transfers weight of the head from spinal bones to muscles at the back of the neck and head. It's thought that this added load on the muscles over time can encourage the development of the growths. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning the world has to adapt to unprecedented changes in the world of work to ensure a sustainable future and create a more just society. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the Secretary General spoke at the International Labor Conference.
In congratulating the International Labour Organization on its centenary anniversary, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres cites the ILO's many achievements in establishing labour standards that have improved the safety and quality of work for millions of people. He says the challenges facing the agency over the next 100 years are likely to be even more daunting.
As we look ahead, we know new technologies, especially artificial intelligence, will inevitably lead to a massive destruction of jobs and a massive creation of new jobs. It is difficult to now foresee all these impacts, but it is clear that the future will require a range of new and different skills.
To keep abreast of new demands, he says governments will have to make large investments in education that are flexible and based on the learning needs of a lifetime. Guterres says the well-being of people must be at the center of economic and social policies. That involves the creation of decent work that is sustainable for the long run. He notes a sustainable future for the world of work is not possible without addressing the urgent demands of climate change.
Addressing the climate emergency is indeed the defining issue of our time. Climate action could create millions of sustainable jobs. Green business has proven to be good business. But climate change is moving faster than we are. And we are risking a future with increased instability, inequality, and poverty.
The UN chief says new momentum must be injected into the climate change debate. He says the new momentum is needed to transform political and economic systems to meet the goals set in the Paris Climate Accord to reduce emissions that are harming the survivability of the planet. He says he hopes to move in that direction by convening a climate action summit in September at UN headquarters in New York. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the United Nations marks the International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence and Conflict this week, an initiative by the foundation of Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege helps to end the stigma of rape survivors. VOA's Salem Solomon has that story.
Sexual violence is a devastating weapon of war accompanied by fear and misunderstanding. Perpetrators are often soldiers who act with impunity. Mildred, a survivor of conflict-related sexual violence from Zimbabwe, wrote, "Rapists have to be brought to justice. But how can we do this when the rapists are those in power?" Mildred is one of the women featured in a new initiative from the foundation of Nobel Peace Prize recipient Dr. Denis Mukwege, designed to empower victims and educate the public about rape in conflict zones. In support of the UN International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence and Conflict, the Mukwege Foundation has created SEMA, the global network of victims and survivors to end wartime sexual violence. SEMA means speak out in Swahili, and the network includes 50 survivors across 21 countries. Milani Laksiminarian, program officer at SEMA, says the program aims to bring survivors together.
We focus on breaking the silence. We focus on building a collective memory. And what we do at the foundation is really provide a platform for these women to come together, to meet, to realize that they're not alone and become more empowered through this in order to fight for their own rights and demand their rights.
African countries are among the most affected by conflict-related sexual violence. In 2018 alone, the United Nations reported 1,049 cases affecting 1,041 women and girls and 8 men and boys in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and 238 incidents involving 1,291 victims in South Sudan, and 179 incidents affecting 259 victims in the Central African Republic. Although these figures are alarming, experts agree the vast majority of incidents go unreported. SEMA is working to break the silence.
I mean, what we've seen with the survivors is the moment that they see that they're not alone, they're much more ready to speak out, because the stigma, if you don't feel that it's your fault, but if you realize this is actually a systematic pattern that's occurring, survivors are then much less likely to either put the blame on themselves or to feel that they have something to be ashamed about.
The Mukwege Foundation provides a platform for survivors to share their stories. It also seeks to secure reparations for survivors and has a treatment model based on holistic care that includes psychological support and legal assistance. Mukwege, a gynecologist, treats more than 3,500 women a year from Panzi Hospital in the DRC. His work to heal rape victims earned him the nickname Dr. Miracle. Rape causes not only physical harm and trauma, it often stigmatizes women within their communities. Some are shunned and made to feel at fault for what happened. SEMA believes that creating an international support network can help decrease that stigma.
At the global level, because women actually see it's happening in other countries, which they often don't realize, they also understand, okay, this is not something that is done specifically to me, but we have this opportunity now to speak about it with others who know exactly what we've gone through, and we can really rely on support with them because they're the ones who really understand.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long Can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. July 2019 marks the 50th anniversary of humanity's first trip to the moon, and to commemorate the occasion, film studios are releasing movies to celebrate. Penelope Pulu is VOA's film correspondent. Penelope, thank you so much for dropping by the studio. You know, we're 50 years after the historic landing on the moon by Apollo 11. How is the film industry commemorating this event?
The recent films that have come out are all one better than the other. The common denominator in the quality of these films is their HD clarity. Many of them on IMAX, some of them on 3D technology. And since the 2000, approximately the year 2000, a lot of filmmakers have come out and managed to get their hands on never seen before archival footage by NASA. It was stored in vaults, in chemicals, and they were able to reprocess that footage, remaster it, because film technology has evolved.
Yes, and if you take a look at what was recorded on back in those days, I mean, film deteriorates over time, so what you're saying about the restoration, the improvements, the technology to preserve that, not only for our generation, but for future generations, that's huge. You also mentioned that each film seems to be building upon the other one, one better than the next, so what's coming down the pipeline?
So one of the major documentaries that is playing right now on TV, as a matter of fact, it was purchased by CNN, is the documentary Apollo 11 by Todd Douglas Miller. The film is an incredible experience because it is using footage shot in 70 millimeter.
Oh, wow.
And they were able to reprocess it in IMAX. I was actually able to see it on its premiere at the IMAX screen at the Air and Space Museum. And what it shows is the week of the moon landing, starting with the launch. Actually, a little bit before the launch, when the anticipation is building, crowds are waiting in Florida to watch the launch, and ending with the astronauts returning to Earth. And when you see that rocket firing up, ready to go up, the countdown, the whole theater is shaking.
In terms of coming out soon.
Another film that is coming actually out very, very soon, in the next week or so, is a PBS six-hour series called Chasing the Moon by Robert Stone. Robert Stone is an acclaimed filmmaker, and he pretty much uses the same type of treatment, but the difference is he is expanding his theme, starting from the beginning of the space race, getting into the history, into the politics, into untold and anecdotal stories, all the way to after the return of the astronauts to the moon. And, of course, another film that it's truly worth mentioning that, I mean, we've seen it here, but many other countries abroad haven't yet, is Damien Chazelle's feature film, First Man, which tells the story of the moon landing from the perspective of Neil Armstrong and his family. But what is, again, pivotal in that film is that the cinematographers have shot scenes to match exactly the archival footage that we have gotten. And again, they have processed all that in HD.
Amazing. Penelope Pulu is VOA's film industry correspondent. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Jackson Munganye, and engineer, Aiden Utku, thank you so much for joining us. Now, for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.